Hi, I'm Michael Hartman.
I'm Naomi Liu.
And I'm Mike Rizzo. And this is OpsCast,
a podcast for marketing ops pros
and RevOps pros.
Created by the MoPros, the number one community for marketing operations professionals.
Tune in to each episode as we chat with real professionals to help elevate you in your marketing operations career.
Hello and welcome to another episode of OpsCast, brought to you by MarketingOps.com, powered by the MoPros. I'm your host, Michael Hartman, flying solo today. Mike and Naomi are both tied up. I think Mike is traveling to Adobe Summit, so gives you a clue on when we recorded this in 2024. So let's get right into it. I am excited to talk to our guest today. Today, I'm going to be talking to Mac Redden, who is the founder of Comsor / Community Club, about Golden Network Motion. So this is part of, I guess we're calling it a sort of a mini series of sort of emerging go-to-market approaches and how they may affect marketing ops professionals. So Mac, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, appreciate you having me.
All right, well, let's get to it. So I want to try to be as precise as I can about the language I'm using. We're saying Golden Network Motion, but when you and I were first introduced, I was introduced to you as the sort of an expert on community-led go-to-market motions. But when we talked, you said that the term you're using now is go-to-network. So maybe help educate those of us who are less familiar with what do the two terms mean and how do you think of them as different? And why the change in terminology if they're not so different?
Yeah, I mean, I think for starters, there's a big asterisk over this. I think B2B especially loves to just over term everything and try to come. Everyone's trying to invent their own term and their own category. And at the end of the day,
everyone needs an acronym, right?
Yeah. Like the market decides what it is at the end of the day. Right. And there's no strategy is ever truly unique. It's all overlapping and whatnot. But yeah, for context, we started about 4 years ago as a company building for this community led growth motion. And really the simple version of that is it's putting community intentionally into your go-to-market process. Now we can sit here and talk about what community means or doesn't mean. And I think that's one of the never ending debates. It's kind of one of the beauties and the dangers of the word community is it comes in many shapes and sizes and forms and things like that. And ultimately what we realized, the transition for us happened, we realized we were trying to help companies measure their single community. And this is something I'm doing community-led growth, therefore I have a community. But in reality, companies are actually made up of lots of different intersecting networks, overlapping networks. Some might be called a community, some might not be, right? People debate, is social media a community? Is my personal network a community? It's yes and no, and we can debate that till the end of time. So for us, go-to-network is sort of an evolution of community-led. It's almost an abstraction. A lot of the principles are the same, and I'll get into the principles of go-to-network in a second, but it's without necessarily having the specificity of a tangible community, which I think is the big difference. I think people think of community, they think of something more tangible of I can go into this Slack space or this physical community or this, forum or whatever, whereas network is a bit broader and open-ended and intentionally. So,
I mean, I think when I used to hear community-led, I would think sort of an owned community more than, so the company that's trying to use that motion, they're trying to build a community of, prospects and customers and others who care, but still managing it. I've been at a place where we talked about doing that. And I think the risk there that I saw was that there's going to try to be a lot of policing of the content that would be shared or used there. And I think that was not a good thing, but that tends to be something that people get scared about.
Yeah. Yeah. And community is hard. And that's, we could spend the whole rest of this podcast talking about the challenges of community and defining community. But the evolved, when we say go to network, essentially it's built on the premise that traditional go-to-market, I'm not going to say it's dead, but it definitely doesn't work the way it used to, right? No. The traditional predictable revenue model, the idea of I hire this many SDRs, I do ads, I do this many motions to get this many meetings, to get this many deals, this direct hunting motion, which is what a lot of go-to-market has been built on for the last 15 years, it doesn't work the way it used to, right? It's you need more cold calls, more emails to get the same amount of meetings, right? And that creates a vicious cycle and all this. So go to network is this idea. It's much more people first instead of account first. And it's based on this principle that companies have to build an inner network of people that they can get to the market through. Partners, community members, champions, investors, advisors, influencer, personal brands, executives, et cetera. It's sort of like flipping the script where if you imagine, you know, most companies traditionally, you have a company and inside the company you have people, almost like flipping that inside out, where it's like you're building this network around the company where, like, you know, the person at the company almost becomes more important than the brand.
Right. It's interesting. So I want to get back into sort of the some of the reasons behind things like go to network approaches in kind of the traditional, if there is a traditional go to market strategy or approach, and why it has sort of evolved. But so I just want to make sure I understand. So go to network is sort of a larger model, and community led can be a component of that, especially if you're thinking about like owned community. But I mean, marketingops.com is a community of marketing ops folks. And I know personally, I've used that to not only learn specific things, but also evaluate, say, technology vendors, right? So is that, am I understanding right? It's part of a go-to-network.
I think it's like the things I think of when I think of go-to-network is community, partnerships, social selling, events, education. It's really about shifting from a push model to a pull model, right? Ads, cold calls, emails, you're pushing out to the market. You're basically going up to the door and be like, hey, Mike, you want to buy my shit?
Right.
And then like, whereas this is more like we're creating things that pull you towards us.
Yeah. We're not doing the door-to-door encyclopedia selling or knife set selling or whatever, Tupperware. Okay, let's get into like the traditional model. It's funny that it's interesting that we've been doing this series with people, and there's very much a theme that part of the shift in these different approaches is because I think people believe that the traditional model that is very viewed as very linear, I think is really not the way that things happen. And correspondingly, we just had an episode recently with Rachel Squire, who she and I talked about the way, like, does measuring the funnel in quotes, right? I'm doing air quotes for our listeners here. Does that still make sense? And I think what we got to was there's this difference between how do you measure the flow of people in sort of a simplified model through your funnel, if you will, even though we all know that the reality of how people buy is very, very different than that. It's not that linear thing. Like, people come in, they spend a lot of time, they do some research, and maybe they come back, maybe they go away, right? So, is it that kind of thing that is driving the go to network approach, is stuff like that, or is there something else that's part of the
thing? I think there's a lot. There's so many compounding factors happening right now. I think 2 or 3 years ago, this idea of the predictable revenue model, the funnel, was already starting to kind of come apart at the seams. And I think, no matter how well it was working 10 years ago, I think the B2B obsession with a perfect linear funnel and perfect attribution was always a false quest for a thing that doesn't exist. Like, it's even if you think you're measuring it perfectly, like dark social, it was never going to be this perfect linear thing. But the system worked, so people kind of ignored it and rolled with it for 10 or 15 years, right? Then there's things like cookies going away, third-party data going away. AI is making this problem worse because, like, I saw a stat recently, and I don't quote me exactly on it because I don't remember the exact number, but it was looking at the amount of outbound touch points that buyers get over the last 5 years, and it was like 9 or 10 times higher. So you see 10 times as many emails, calls, ads, LinkedIn messages as you would have 5 years ago. AI is making that worse. So it's like, it's creating this vicious cycle in a way. It's almost like an Ouroboros, right? If you know, it's like the snake consuming its own tail, where this quest for perfect attribution and automation and scalability created a very system that is actually devouring itself, because as we automate it more, as we scale it more, as we make it more and more activities, buyers actually pull further and further and further back from the system, which requires us to do more automation and do more activities, which in turn makes buyers pull back. And it's like, we've been in this sort of spiral for a while. And I think the last 2 or 3 years, the cracks finally became apparent to a lot more people than it was.
I think underlying all this, right, is this belief that it's a volume-based game, right?
Yeah.
Just like the more stuff you shove out into the early stages of your funnel, the more that's going to come out. Your conversion rates are going to be consistent regardless of, and so I think all that is
false. And that worked in like a, you know, for 10 years in a zero interest rate environment where it was like, right. you could do that, show growth, didn't worry about profitability. And I just, I can't remember the exact term I saw, but someone said growth at all costs is out, sustainable growth is in. And I think that's the difference, is like this predictable volume game is very, it's very short-term minded. Right? You're not worrying about the long-term implications. You're not worrying about churn, not worrying about, will my company be here in 10 years? Because most companies for the last 20 years were built on the assumption they're either going to go public very quickly, die very quickly, or get acquired very quickly. So who cared about the 10-year vision?
Hey everyone, it's Mike Rizzo here, and I'm interrupting your episode to bring you a brief message about, you might have guessed it, Mopsapalooza 2024, our second annual conference held in the vibrant city of Anaheim, California. We're hosting this hybrid event from the 5th of November through the 8th, and we would love for you to join us in person in Anaheim. But if you can't, please join us via live stream, courtesy of our sponsor, Excel Events. We're excited to offer an opportunity for professionals just like you to connect, learn, and grow among the best in the industry. Our event promises to be a highlight of the year, offering invaluable professional development experiences, live workshops, and of course, networking with your peers. Don't miss out on this incredible gathering right next to Disneyland in Southern California. Tickets are going fast. We will cap registration at 700 attendees. Secure your pass by visiting marketingops.com today, and we're looking forward to welcoming you to what is guaranteed to be an unforgettable event. It might just be the best event you've ever attended. But don't take my word for it. You can ask the community at any time. We'll see you there.
No, I think all of that rings true. And it's funny, literally like an hour ago, I was talking to somebody about sort of a metrics framework that I'm working on. And we talked about attribution, and we both sort of agreed that attribution is still useful, but you should not expect it to be, I even hate to use the term right or accurate, right? It should be it's useful as a directional tool. Right. Are we are we moving the needle in the right direction? Are we hitting the right types of audiences? Are we underperforming here, overperforming there? Right. Those kinds of things I think are still valuable, but it's probably been misused by a lot of people who are trying to be, in quotes, right? Air quotes again, data driven.
Yeah. Which I just said this to someone recently. I think this quest for perfect attribution, but also for like everything has to be measurable. So people look. It's like humans are so good at finding patterns where patterns don't exist because we love making things explainable. We love looking and be like, oh, look, I can prove that this system worked because this. And it's like, I can't remember the example someone used, but there's like, you can take pretty much any data set and you can make it tell the story you want to tell, depending on how you slice it, how you view it, how you display it. Like, data will tell the story you want to tell at the end of the day, and you'll mold it in your vision consciously or not.
I think of a couple of things when I think of data like that, is that two things. One, I've probably mentioned it many times here and certainly other places, is Mark Twain's quote, "There are lies, damn lies, and statistics," right? Very much true. And if you don't know how statistics work, it's easy to fool people. The other, this is totally out of left field, but there's a researcher on like the study of happiness. His name is Sean Acor. And he has a TED talk that kind of blew up. Maybe I can find it and post a link to it here in the show notes or something later. But he sort of was joking about in his research, right? Here's this pattern. He showed up a slide, like pattern of data. And he goes, I see these things out here. They're anomalies. I'm going to take them out, right? So it's easy to sort of like have it tell the story you want. And the sad thing is, that's probably 10 years ago when that, like now I think actually that kind of stuff we're finding is happening more often than not in research, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah. That's a rabbit hole. We definitely don't have time to go into.
Okay. So, we talked about community as sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, a pillar of, a go-to network approach. You mentioned like there's other aspects of go to network. So maybe talk us through what are some of the other things you think of was go to network, like definitionally, what's included?
I mean, like partnerships, events, content, social selling, a lot of things that are putting, it's really like you're putting trust basically first. and it's authentic relationship and trust, right? It's like the reason why a referral works so well is because there's trust. The reason why a partnership works so well is because there's trust. The reason why a community works so well is because the community becomes a vessel through which you build trust, right? And it's like, I think so many sales motions try to like, it's like a vampire. You know, like the thing of like vampires can't come inside unless they're invited in.
Yeah.
It's like so many sales motions have assumed they're just going to open the door and they're going to be like, hey, I'm here to sell to you. And it's like, well, hold up. Like, I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you. So a lot of go to network is really about like, you're trying to build human first trust before you get to the sale. You're trying to build systems that enable that sort of stuff to happen. You're putting people first. It's not account first. So yeah. Like the partnerships, social selling, all that sort of stuff plays into it. Community for sure. And it's funny, I actually had someone recently when I was saying a similar thing, they're like, well, that all sounds like a marketing problem and not a sales problem, but you're kind of talking about it like it's a sales problem. And at the end of the day, it's like, it's the same problem, right? Marketing and sales are on the same team. It's a revenue problem. Right. And all the best salespeople that I know, they have at least a little bit of their brain working like a marketer, right? They are building their own brand on LinkedIn. They're thinking about content. They're thinking about educating their buyer. They have a marketing tilt to them compared to like a script following robot salesperson.
Well, and I would argue that when I think of salespeople that I've liked working with as a buyer, they're I'll get two very different ones. One is a person we bought multiple cars from at a dealership. Yeah. I now trust him to tell me like, hey, this is not the right time, right? Rates are off, like, you know, things like, and I like now I'm like, I go, before I do anything, I go to him and I like, okay, well this, like, tell me what you think I should do or not do at this point. And it's usually been solid advice. So he's like, to some degree, walked away from the short-term gain he might get for a longer-term relationship. And we have now bought 5 cars, something like that.
Going to network is definitely a long-term mindset compared to traditional
strategies. Yeah. And then the other is a salesperson in MarTech who I still think of to this day. I won't mention her name, but she was an early sales leader at Eloqua. And I was trying to bring Eloqua on board. And I not only did she invest a lot of time in just educating me, but I had at the time a supervisor who had been burned by another vendor and was really challenging all kinds of stuff, like little stuff. And she was with me the whole way, trying to help answer all these questions. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody else invest that amount of time for what was at the end of the day, a relatively small deal. And it still stands out to me as valuable. And it's again, that builds that trust that you're going to be there with them.
Yeah.
So it's funny that I do think it's not just a marketing problem. I'm surprised that people think that's a marketing problem.
Well, I think there is still some of this like old school mindset of like, it's marketing's problem to get a lead and throw it over to me as a salesperson. Right. Which is like, you're 10 years out of date if you're still thinking that way.
Like with a short period of my life when I was in sales, I mean, that was what I did. I did cold calling. I wasn't relying on.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't really have marketing. It was as a consultancy. And I mean, I worked my tail off to get my own leads, right? I got hung up on. I was doing the full life cycle, right? I was doing cold calling all the way through trying to close deals.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of stats that have shown that reps who self-source perform better than those who just pick up what's put in front of them. I can't remember the exact number, but it was like 40 or 50% higher performance than non-full cycle reps.
So okay. So I think in general, right, I like this idea of go to network. I'm a big believer in networks and the value of them. It's a buyer for sure. So I can see why they would be useful if you're a company trying to sell and you leverage the networks of your employees and partners, et cetera. I'm going to throw one thing out, but I want you to poke holes at it and then also tell me what else I'm missing. But it feels like, because there's got to be this, building trust takes time, right? There's got to be a culture that enables sales and marketing, the rest of the revenue function to be able to do that. And probably correspondingly need, customers to actually get value fairly quickly once they do buy. So there's this onboarding component as well. But it feels like there needs to be a cultural component to this for sure.
Absolutely.
So, but what else is kind of needed to make a go-to-network approach work?
I think for starters, it is definitely a mindset and a cultural problem. to start. Like, no tool is going to solve this problem for you. I mean, realistically, very few tools solve problems without mindset and people changes, right? And enablement changes. And that's like the biggest scam in software ever is people think software will just do it for them. And it's like, well, not really. Right? Like, buying a hammer doesn't hammer the nail in. You still got to know how to swing the hammer.
Yeah, it may swing the hammer faster and just as inaccurately, but
yeah. It might require less hits if it's a better hammer. It might break less often, but like, you still need to know how to hammer the nail.
Right.
So I think that is the biggest thing. I think a lot of it is, I think a lot of the ways that sales and marketing teams are comped and structured is part of the problem too, right? Companies are built on this quarterly window. And I'm not trying to say companies should throw it out the window. And I know that's a very unrealistic change to suggest, but because like, think about it, if you're selling like true enterprise software, there's a very good chance that your deal cycles are longer than a quarter. Yeah. So how can you operate on a quarterly measurement basis when it takes longer than a quarter for a deal to actually happen, from marketing to lead to close to onboarding, all that sort of stuff? So I think companies have to give at least some space to think and operate with that sort of long-term mindset. And what I've pitched companies is, you know, once again, they're not going to change overnight, but they need to carve out 10 or 20% of their time to think with that long-term mindset, or else they might not realize it this quarter. They might not realize it next quarter. They might not realize it this year, but eventually that short-term mindset will catch up. And I mean, there's that stat, I think it's Gartner or something, that only 5% of your buyers are in market at any given time. So if only 5% of your buyers are in market at any given time, you can only probably sell to 5% right now. So your go-to-network strategy should be applying to the other 95% so that you're there when they buy. The other stat that I think is super relevant to that is that most buyers, at least in the enterprise software space, typically come with a shortlist in mind. By the time they're actually talking to your sales team, they've already narrowed down, you know, the three choices that are the finalists. So a go-to-network strategy is really about like getting yourself on that finalist list. Yes. And at that point, that's when a traditional sales process can be run. But so many sales teams are focused on opening that door when like buyers don't buy from salespeople just opening the door, right? They buy from referrals, they do their own research, all that sort of stuff. So the go-to-network is really the system to make sure you can be in the room to run a sales process when the sales process becomes necessary.
Right, right. It's kind of,
it's not getting rid of salespeople.
It's about building up trust. Trust is one of those things, like in any relationship, that takes time and it's hard. It requires work to do it. And it's sadly, it's relatively easy to undermine, right? You can lose trust points, if you will, pretty quickly. So the more you have put in the bank of that trust, in your trust bank with someone, the more likely you are going to be able to suffer, you know, handle a setback.
Yeah. You have to give a shit to start, right? You can only fake trust so far, right? Like the salesperson who's like, oh, okay, I'm going to be the trusted advisor, but like, they're really just there to close the deal. Like, you as a buyer, you're going to see through that pretty quickly eventually, at least across the whole. So like, it does require this like individual mindset shift first. And then
that's a really good point. And then I think that's a really good point too, that the individual mindset needs to be a part of it. So that also implies to me that as part of, if you're an organization that's using that kind of approach, it needs to be embedded into your, not just your culture, but your hiring process, right? How do you find people that have that kind of mindset is going to be really important.
I think the whole like hustle sales bro culture is completely at odds with this approach. The commission breath approach, if you will.
Yeah. It's interesting. Okay. That all makes sense. So, okay, this is all great. Theoretically, sounds good. Do you have any examples where something like this has had I'll use the word success, but it depends on how you define it, I suppose, but where you've seen at least a positive impact on an organization in terms of their revenue or growth?
I can see it on ourselves 100%, just to use ourselves as an example. So we pivoted from this community-led product to this more go-to-network product. So we kind of went quiet for 9 months last year and then relaunched ourselves out of stealth again in January. But for the 3 to 4 months leading up to that launch, we spent a ton of time basically investing in our network, you know, actually getting to know people, like letting people get to know our people. Like we hadn't even launched our product. Nobody knew what our product was. It just had like a coming soon page on our website, but we were out there going to events, going to dinners, getting to know people, helping people out, all that sort of stuff. Also at the same time, we're learning, right? There's, you can't underscore that. Like
absolutely.
I can't underscore that enough. Like we're learning by talking to people, but we're talking about them in an authentic or it, with them in an authentic way. And we built this network of people that before we even launched our product, before they even knew exactly what we were building, they liked us. They considered themselves fans of ours. And I'm skimming over like a ton of details to give the high level version of this. But when we launched, we basically reached out to about 200 of these people and said, hey, like you've been a big part of the journey the last few months. Do you want to be part of our launch on LinkedIn? And we had 140, I can't remember if it was 42, 48, but we had over 100 people who basically on our launch day dedicated their like daily LinkedIn post to talking about us launching. It was like 1.2 to 1.5 million impressions. We are still getting leads from that from end of January. And it was just because we went into this authentic approach, this long-term mindset, like you said, we were able to cash out of that trust piggy bank a little bit.
Right.
And people were willing to jump in and do things with us and do things worth. And it was, and it wasn't even just like they were willing to do things for us. They were like honored to have been asked to help us. Right. Yeah. If I had just been like, hey, Michael, you want to buy our shit? Hey, Michael, you want to buy our shit? And then I was like, also, do you want to help me promote my product? You'd be like, no, I don't. Right. But like, think about the car salesman or the Eloqua salesperson you mentioned, right? They, you're talking about them because of their approach to selling, their approach to building relationships. So it's like, I just, whenever someone asks me for an example, I'll always end it with, look at your own buying practices. Look at the salespeople that you respect. Look at the salespeople that you're buying from. I guarantee that they are selling in this sort of mindset, even if you're not realizing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and there's obviously the counterpoints, right? The ones that don't do that and how you feel about them, right? They're the ones who give.
It's you know, how often you get bad sales outreach or pushy salespeople, or like you get stuck on a sequence and you're like, this company has contacted me 32 times in 60 days. Like, holy shit, this is insane.
Well, like when I, or when I've told, by the time I engage with a sales team and I'm asking for a demo or something, I'm like, I'm really asking for a demo. I don't want your bullshit, you know, slide deck about your company. Cause I already done my research, right? When I say I want a demo, give me a demo. So if you got 30 minutes with me and you start talking about this other stuff, I'm probably going to just stop it and say,
you know what I really want to see that I've seen nobody do yet. And this feels like something that a marketing ops person could do or should do. I want to see like a choose your own adventure demo form. I've never seen a company do this where it's like you should, I should be able to say, hey, I'm requesting a demo and I want just a demo. I've already done my research, or I'm just kicking the tires. I need a salesperson who's going to kind of talk me through the whole thing, like more discovery call, or like, I'm ready to buy. Just give me pricing info. Like I have never seen a demo form that lets a buyer self-select into what stage of the buying process they're actually in. And then you get like, because if you're at that later stage, you're like, I'm ready to buy. Just give me the demo. Give me pricing. I don't want to get on an SDR discovery call. Like I'm past that, as you mentioned, right? But actually, I'm going to make that our demo form. That's what our demo form is going to be. By the time this episode comes out, I'm changing
it. You've got a couple of weeks. That's about it. All right.
Be a fun experiment.
No, I think that's really interesting. I mean, well, I mean, we can talk about, like, I would love to see these vendors also offer short-term paid options for people who really want to evaluate it, right? As opposed to a free pilot for 2 weeks is usually not enough, right? Whether you can't, and you're usually not getting something that's real. And I'd be a big fan of, like, I'd be willing to pay a little bit to truly evaluate something. And then I've got skin in the game, but that's a whole separate side of this. But
basically, at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is like putting the buyer's experience first, right? So many sales and marketing processes feel like they're designed for that perfectly predictable funnel, and they're designed for a manager to sit and look at pretty measurable graphs. They are not designed for the human buyer who's actually interfacing with that.
Totally agree. And I think if, I suspect there's a lot of people in our listening audience who are looking for a job. One of the things they could in marketing ops, and one of the things they could do to offer a company who's looking to hire somebody is actually to go through that process as if they were a buyer for that company.
Yeah.
And talk about what that experience is like, because I don't think a lot of people do pay attention to that. The example I like to use is, I think there's still this big push in a lot of places to do nurture streams, right? Email streams. And I don't have anything per se against those. What I don't think is happening out there is people are signing up to get, you know, a piece of content and going, I cannot wait till they send me that next email. Nobody's out
there.
If anything,
you're like, if anything, you get the second email and you go, oh shit, unsubscribe. Didn't mean to get that.
Yeah. I mean, and I generally don't unsubscribe to many things just because I am curious to see what people are doing and all that. But it's not, I think I'm definitely an outlier in that.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people are very quick to do that kind of thing. They'll unsubscribe.
Yeah. I'm like, if I don't unsubscribe quickly, my inbox becomes unmanageable very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I've had to pay to expand the storage for my email just simply because I don't do that.
Yeah.
So but it's helpful for me anyway. Okay. So you mentioned marketing ops. I'm going to bounce around here a little bit maybe, but so since our audience is primarily marketing ops, rev ops type people, maybe some marketers, you know, one of the things we want to get to is like, okay, well, I gave one example, right? If you're looking to get hired with a company who is thinking about go to network, right? How can you advocate for that? How can you support it? What are the things that you think marketing ops teams can do to support this kind of approach to the market?
I mean, I think a lot of it is, there's so many ways. I think so much marketing technology that, you know, marketing ops teams might be owning or implementing has taken the human out of the loop. I think so much marketing and sales tech has, subconsciously or not, trained us as sales and marketers to push button, get value. Push button, start a sequence. Push button, get enriched data. Push button, push button, push button. It's like, it's taken the art out of it. And it's taken this, like, once again, the understanding that, like, not everybody, like a one size fits all automation is very unlikely going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's times and places for it for sure. But I think that's one thing. I think so many, I think putting themselves in the buyer's shoes and actually like go fill out your company's demo form, like pretend you're a buyer, see what the experience is actually like really reflect when you're going through a buying process. You should be looking at, what do I like? What do I not like? What's good? What's bad? And then taking that back to your own company and being like, oh shit, like I hate this. Why are we doing this? Like if I hate it, why would our buyers like this? Right. I think also just like putting people first. Most sales tools, especially in, you know, for the context, we're talking B2B world here, they are account first, right? I only put you in my CRM because you're at a company. I don't put you like there's this idea of like, how can you structure your data and your tools to actually enable your company to care about relationships long term? And it's like, right, because like think about tech like user gems or even what we're building with Bronto, things like that, where it actually focuses on the person, right? User gems is like, this person changed jobs. Like there's bits and pieces of tech out there that are starting to enable sales and marketing teams to think at like an actual people relationship level rather than an account relationship level. And that's where I would be looking if I were trying to set up new flows, new tools, new systems, new analytics that think about supporting this sort of mindset shift.
Do you think any of these also have, and this totally, I'm putting you on the spot here, any of these tools that can, so I love the idea, first off, let me back up. I love the idea of knowing where, I'll call them good customers, have moved to where they're moving to another company that is not currently a customer, that kind of thing. I think it's a great like source of potential revenue. What I don't know is if there's any tools that can help identify, for like, I don't even know how to put this, the quality of the current, the relationship with the person where they were a customer, right? How strong is it? How long has it been? Would they be?
I mean, I don't know if you are unintentionally doing the perfect tee up for me, because that's literally what we're building.
Oh, I am not. I am not. That is not intentional at all. So there you go. Take advantage of it.
So that is, we're trying to figure out like the actual, like if you know, Crossbeam, right? Like our partnership tools that look like, oh, I'm partnered with your company. What accounts do we both know? What we're trying to build is essentially not what accounts does our company know, but what people does our company know? Oh,
yeah.
Our executive knows Mac really well, or this investor of ours knows this person really well, or this customer of ours knows that person really well. Like we're trying to build like a relationship intelligence tool. We joke that like we're putting the R back in CRM because CRMs are really not relationship managers. Like ironically, like they're structured note-taking tools and management tools. They're not managers.
Like marketing automation platforms are not really about automation either.
Exactly. But so we're trying to build like what would an actual relationship manager look like that puts people first instead of accounts first. I will say, hard as shit problem to solve.
Yeah.
It's I think part of the reason why people have always fallen back to this predictable revenue model and account-based model is because it's a lot easier to measure. It's a lot easier to understand. I put this in, I put a dollar in, I get $2 out. What right. we're talking about is a little bit like I put a dollar in, it gets buried for 6 months. I don't know where it goes. And $3 pops up in a different place. And I think it's from that dollar, but I don't really know. It's like, it's a much, you know, it's a much more realistic path. And it's sometimes hard to build.
Yeah, it's interesting. I literally just this morning was listening to a different podcast. It was really like more of a CMO focused one where they were talking about how do you communicate the long-term value of a marketing investment, particularly if you've got a long-term sell that's a high dollar value. And the analogy that was suggested was something around investing, right? So if you put a dollar into your 401k now, right, it's you don't see the dividend this year. It's years from now. And likewise, if you pull investing from your 401k now, it doesn't affect you this year. It affects you down, right? It's yeah. So there's this, and I think that rings well with the people who are tend to be the ones who stop things, right? CFOs and CEOs yeah. who are familiar with the financials. So I still am noodling on whether or not I'm totally bought in on that, but it's as good as anything else I've heard. So
I love the analogy of hunting versus farming, right? I think a lot of sales and marketing over the last 20 years has been more like hunting, right? You're like, yes. And yeah, hunting, for a bit of a gruesome analogy, might get you your meal tonight if you're yes. successful. You might not be, because we all know like hunting is maybe it works, maybe it doesn't.
Right.
Whereas like what we're talking about here, the long-term mindset is like planting a garden, right? You got to plant it out a bit. You got to make space for it. You got to plant it. You got to nurture it. You got to tend to it. It might not pay off today, but once it does, it's healthier. It's cheaper. It's tastes better, like than going to the store and buying vegetables. So it's like this mindset of gardening.
It's renewable.
Versus hunting. Right. It's renewable. It's more sustainable, right? Like once again, if you go and you shoot all the deer in the forest, like, oops, tough shit. You can't grow anymore.
Right. It's interesting. Okay. So it sounds like for marketing ops folks, kind of going back to that question, I think it's a matter yeah. of, you know, looking for these new kinds of technologies that would enable really understanding those complicated interrelationships of the network between, you know, through your different stakeholder groups. It's funny because I feel like probably 15, 20 years ago, I remember some tool, I feel like it was on top of like Facebook, but something like that, that like did try to do a visualization of your network, right?
Yeah.
To X number of degrees out. And it was interesting. And then I think Facebook shut it down. Like they wouldn't, it was a third party thing, but it was great. Like it was actually really interesting. And I'm surprised that it hasn't, maybe that's what you all are doing, but we can
a little bit. People have tried different iterations of it. I think part of it is like, you know, this like timing is part of it. I think also part, honestly, if I had been trying to pitch the market we're building now 4 years ago, nobody would have given a shit, because it's like the old way of doing things was working.
Right.
The pain of needing a new way to do things or a better way of doing things wasn't there. Nowadays, I can't tell you often I talk to a CRO or a CMO and they're like, Mac, everything we do isn't working. The system we had 2 years ago, it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
We have no idea. We have literally no idea what to do.
Right. Yeah. We're not meeting our, you know, yeah. we're predicting our revenue X quarters out and we're not hitting. You know,
yeah. And they're like, their board is setting an arbitrary goal, which filters down to the CEO, which filters down to the right. CRO, which filters. And they're like, they just pulled a number out of our ass basically.
Right. Yeah. So something just popped in my head that I want to go back a little bit about talking yeah. about the trust component. And so it just occurred to me that something I've talked about in my role as heading marketing ops before with some marketing leadership teams is that part of what we should be doing, and this is, I didn't even think to call it, you know, a network kind of thing, but is, you know, what we should be doing with marketing is earning the right to ask for.
Be a vampire.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, does that resonate with this kind of go to network model as well?
Yeah. My favorite model is this, or visualization is the push versus pull, right? Instead of trying to push out to the market, you're trying to pull the market to you, which is effectively earning the right. You're making them want to hear from you, right? If you think about the best consumer brands, right? They're described as cult-like. Apple, Nike.
Yes.
Right? People like wait in line for those products. Like, is a Nike shoe better than an Adidas shoe? I mean, someone might hear this and like come like, you know, knock on my door and want to argue about it. No,
people are religious about it for sure, right?
Right. And B2B brands, just there's exceptions, but as a whole, they don't actually build a thing that people want to come be a part of. They're always pushing out to the market. They're always saying like, hey, hey, buy our shit. Hey. Instead of like,
well, and they're describing it in what, I mean, my big pet peeve about most B2B companies is you go to their website and unless you know what it is they do, like if you came into it sort of, would have no fucking idea what they sold.
Yeah.
Like, cause they don't use a language that connects in it. And I think this is a little bit of a downside, and I'm sorry to all my friends who are content and creative type people, but like, I think there's a point where you get too clever.
Yeah.
When you try to be a quote thought leader, it's to the point where like now when I hear like, we want to be a thought leader in our space, I'm like, oh.
So I
do we really?
Oh, who was it that told me this? Simon Bowen, I think it was a few weeks ago, told me this thing. He said, everyone wants to be a thought leader, but what you should really aim to be is a sage. Because a thought leader is about me. A thought leader is like, I'm the hero of the story.
Right.
But a sage is the trusted, once again, trust coming back. And he used the analogy of Yoda, right? Luke lands and meets Yoda. And he's like, what? This little old green man is like the master who's going to teach me stuff. And he like tries to beat him and Yoda like kicks his ass. And he tries again, Yoda kicks his ass. He's like, oh, and like Yoda's like this wise old man who's guiding him to become the hero. Like Luke becomes the thought leader, essentially, in that analogy. But like, a thought leader is very me-centric. It's like, look at me, look at my thoughts, versus the real goal as a company is like, if I'm selling to marketing ops people, or I'm selling to salespeople or marketers or whoever, insert whoever you're selling to, your goal as a company should be the trusted voice that's going to guide those people to get promotions, get hired, make more money, save time. And somewhere along the line, I think B2B forgot, right? Like at the end of the day, the reason we sell things to other business people is to make money, save time, get a promotion, succeed at work, whatever it is. Like, you're a guide for those people, not a thought leader. And there's this weird, like, this trend right now with like B2B influencers where everyone's like, oh, like I want my CEO to be like famous on LinkedIn because that'll drive things. And it's like, yeah, it does work short term. But I think, I don't know, it's just the power of words, but I love the framing of like, be a sage and a trusted guide rather than a thought leader.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a place, there's a handful of brands out there and people will know who they are probably that, you know, a part of their brand image, I think is they're serious, but they're also fun, right? They're not so serious. They can't poke fun at themselves. They don't assume that they're the only player. Like, and I think they try to add value in a way that is not trying to talk down to people. And I think those kinds of brands are ones that I'm interested in. And I think people follow them, even if they're not a customer. And that's a huge value that is hard to quantify.
I got three leads referred to me this morning from someone who's been following my content and our company for the last 9 months on LinkedIn. They will likely never be a customer of ours. They don't fit. They don't work in the industry that makes sense for us. But because we built a brand that's like fun and approachable and something they want to be a part of, that's the thing. Is like B2C brands that succeed, they create something that people want to be a part of. Like the brand transcends product, right? Nike, Apple, those examples again. Whereas like think about like Red Bull, like the fact that like, one of our internal things I said a few months ago to our team was like, I kind of want to be the Red Bull of B2B marketing. Whereas like, I think about like Red Bull, like, they make half their revenue comes from what started out as marketing initiatives for them, right? Their marketing initiatives got so good and so interesting that they actually became money makers themselves.
Like, it's so funny you bring up Red Bull because I have three teenage boys and we were actually talking about Red Bull the other day and how all these crazy things that they sponsor that have absolutely nothing to do with energy drinks.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
Not even just sponsor. There's a Red Bull soccer team, Red Bull are the Formula One champions, right? They're not even sponsoring anymore. They're actually like starting to partake in the sports and push them forward and make money. What started as marketing actually became profit for them. And I love that lens of like, my marketing should be so good that it could on its own make money, even if I didn't have my product to market behind it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think everybody can do that, right? There's probably some limits.
It's very aspirational, but it's a mindset again.
Right. I think the point is, right, it required another thing that I think most marketing leaders don't get, which is they don't get the benefit of being able to allocate some of their budget towards things that are either really hard to measure, especially measure in the short term, that don't contribute to especially net new acquisition, but they certainly don't have stuff. Most marketers don't get the benefit of saying, I'm just going to try crazy stuff that I think is going to have long-term benefit, but I'm not like, you got to trust me that it's going to help. And if it doesn't, fine. And I'm not talking, it's like in the 10% of your budget, right? Hold it for.
I think every team at every company, 10% of their budget and time should be put towards experimenting and trying immeasurable things. Whether you're a product team trying a new product idea, whether you're a marketing team trying a crazy marketing stunt, whether you're a sales team changing and trying a strategy that might not work at all. Across the board, 10% of your budget and time, no matter who you are, no matter what team you are, no matter what industry you're in, should be spent on learning, iterating, and trying new stuff.
Yeah. I think it was Kyle Lacy who I first heard this say, CMO that we had on as a guest at one point, but he was the first one I heard, like that's what he does. And he says, I'm going to do stuff and we're not going to measure it, period.
Yeah.
Right. Now he's earned the right to be able to do that. But I think more marketers could do that in this era.
I think a lot of marketers want to, it's their managers who need to give them the space to do it, to be fair.
True. At the same time, I think some of the responsibility for that being more of the norm should be borne by marketers.
Oh yeah. It's a shared responsibility, but it's easy for me to sit here and say that every company should spend 10% of their budget trying new things when I'm the one who decides where our budget goes in our company. Right. It's very easy for me to say that. So I just, I'm very well aware of the fact that marketing people might listen to this and go I wish I could do that, but no way in hell would my manager let
right.
me.
Yeah, I think that is the reality. But I'm a big believer that a big part of marketing's challenges, and there's definitely a lot of pressure on CMOs, right, who are getting displaced in some large brands right now. That part of this is their own doing, right? They've failed at what they should be good at, which is telling a story.
Yeah. Telling a story is not, if you try and tell a story that's perfectly measurable, you're probably telling a shit story.
Yeah. Or if you're not, yeah. Anyway, so that by itself is a whole another topic, but let's wrap this up with, you're in this space, you're doing it yourself. You've got a product that can enable it. And it sounds like good based on your description of how you launched, but what's the reception in the marketplace out there beyond sort of your own products in terms of the idea of doing this go-to-network approach?
So bringing this back to community-led as well, one of the reasons that we started pivoting was that when we started shifting from selling community-led to community people and selling it more directly to CMOs and CROs, we always got hit with interesting, but what do you mean by that? It was the word community, once again, just so confusing. So I was right out the gate, sales and marketing leaders seem to get the concept of go-to-network much faster. They understand it right out the gate. I don't have to educate them quite as hard because what we're talking about is really a bunch of building blocks that people already know. It's just making it more of a forefront of your strategy rather than a secondary part of your strategy. So it's not really teaching you anything fully net new in a lot of ways, or there's always at least some element of it that's recognizable and they can latch onto. I would say my reactions that I've gotten from the market, it's a third, a third, a third, roughly. About a third are this makes a ton of sense. I'm in, let's do it. A third are interesting. This could be interesting. I want to learn about it. And a third are absolutely not. And that third are they're very focused on using AI and automation to do more of what they already know. I think it's a pretty common thing, right? When the economy isn't easy, you go back to 2008 or now, whatever, you kind of get two breeds of people. You get those who double down on what they know and what feels safe. Mm-hmm. And you get those who go, all right, well, screw it. Might as well try new shit if it's not working anyway. So it's you kind of get those two camps to this sort of thinking. But to go back to the Ouroboros and the snake devouring itself, I say this all the time, a lot of sales and marketing teams right now feel like Thelma and Louise, right? They're in a car, they're heading towards a cliff. They know they're heading towards a cliff. but they're still debating how to make the car go faster instead of being like, what right. if we just like turn the car and try something different?
Well, so it's interesting because my perspective is longer than yours and maybe a lot of our listeners, in that to me, as I've had these conversations, some of it feels like stuff that was common 20, yeah. 25 years ago with sort of new wrapper on it. I know it's not the case because technology and all these other things are here.
At the same time, like, new, for sure.
part of what we talked about is like building trust is to me, it's like, if I had a football team to build, American football, to be clear,
yeah.
right? I would probably start both on offense and defense with the line, right? Yes. Do I need skill players? But, when my kids goes to the University of Arkansas, and last year they had arguably a great quarterback, but he had no time to do anything, right? The offensive yeah. line was a problem, right? And so to me, like this fundamentals of basics, so building trust, right? If you can't do that, it's going to be hard to do just about any approach, go to market, let alone, you yeah. know, the, what do you call it? Like inviting the vampire in, right?
Yeah.
Approach.
Yep. Well, I mean, so, it's like what's old is new again, right? It's like, I say the sales leaders who started their sales career 20 years ago, they get it way faster. And it's almost like this reverse bell curve of like
yeah.
people who really only started their sales marketing career in the last 3 to 5 years and never really saw the 10 years of like relatively easiness, they get it. The ones who are the ones heading towards a cliff and just want to make the car go faster, they're the ones who started their sales and marketing career 10, 12, 15 years ago. And then the bell curve kind of comes back up again when you get back yeah. to like folks who started their sales career in the late 90s, early 2000s, where it's like I spoke to a guy who's a sales leader at a, like a 300 person, like prefab concrete company, like mm-hmm. not the industry. And he's like, oh yeah, relationship-based selling. Like that's how we've always done it. And it kind of makes me think of like, you think about like, you know, like countries like China or whatnot, where they skipped right to 5G. They skipped landlines and went straight to mobile phones, right? Because like right. they never had this like tech debt of like, this is how we do things. So they were able just to jump straight into the new technology very quickly, versus like those in that middle of the bell curve, they've spent their entire career perfecting a marketing automation, sales automation, outreach, sequence-based right. world. So convincing them to change is significantly harder than almost the ones who are actually technologically further behind in tools and systems than right. that group.
Yeah. No, that does not surprise me that that's the experience you're seeing, being kind of on that earlier end of being in my yeah. sales and marketing career. So, well, hey, Mac, this has been really, really fun and interesting, and I've learned a lot. So is there anything that we wanted to cover that we haven't covered? You want to make sure our listeners hear from, and then we'll go from there.
I mean, we can record a whole other episode. And I think we touched on a bunch of good stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, so with that, if folks do want to learn more about what you're doing, and you mentioned Bronto, is that, did yeah. I get it right? Yeah. Like yeah. what's going on with that? Like what's the best way for them to kind of learn more about this and or connect?
Yeah.
With
I mean,
you?
It's bronto.co. Bronto, like the dinosaur. Speaking of earlier, you said brands that are fun and don't take themselves too seriously. Our logo is a dinosaur and we lean into that pretty heavily. Yeah. There's lots of things. You can find me on LinkedIn. My name, I think I'm the only Mac Redden on LinkedIn. So it's pretty easy to find me. Okay. I'm always happy to just like shoot the shit. Like, truly, like not from a sales perspective, anyone just wants to ask questions about GoToNetwork or get feedback on an idea. This is the stuff I think about all day, and I love thinking right. about it. I love talking about it. So I'm happy to be a resource for people.
Well, it's true to the brand, right? So
it's the only way to do it.
There you go. Well, great, Mac. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks to all of our listeners for continuing to support us, providing us good feedback and support. Thanks for all our guests. Thanks, Mac, for joining me today. And we will talk to everyone again soon. Bye, everyone.